Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This is July 3rd, 2012, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 18, Maharaj Bricket cursed by a Brahmin boy, Text 26. Prati Rudendriya Prana.
Prati Rudendriya
Prana.
Mano Buddhim Uparatam.
Mano Buddhim Uparatam.
Stana Trayat Param Praptam.
Stana Trayat Param Praptam.
Brahma Bhutam Avikriyam.
Brahma Bhutam Avikriyam.
Prativruta.
Prativruta.
Restrained.
Restrained.
Indriya.
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 The sense organs.
Prana.
Prana.
Air of respiration.
Air of respiration.
Manaha.
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 The mind.
The mind.
Mind.
Buddhim.
Buddhim.
Intelligence.
Intelligence.
Upartatam.
Upartatam.
Inactive.
Inactive.
Stana.
Stana.
Places.
Stana. Places.
Trayat.
Trayat.
From the three.
From the three.
From the three.
Param.
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 Transcendental.
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 Praptam.
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 Achieved.
Achieved.
Brahma Bhutam.
Brahma-bhutam.
Qualitatively equal with the Supreme Absolute.
Qualitatively equal with the Supreme Absolute.
Avikriyam.
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 Unaffected. Prabhupada's translation. The Muni's sense organs, breath, mind, and intelligence were all restrained from material activities. And he was situated in a trance apart from the three. And he was situated in a trance apart from the three, wakefulness, dream, and unconsciousness, having achieved a transcendental position qualitatively equal with the Supreme Absolute. Purport. It appears that the Muni, in whose hermitage the king entered, was in yogic trance. The transcendental position is attained by three processes, namely the process of jnana, or theoretical knowledge of transcendence, the process of yoga, or factual realization of trance by manipulation of the physiological and psychological functions of the body, and the most approved process of bhakti yoga, or the engagement of senses in the devotional service of the Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita also, we have the information of the gradual development of perception from matter to a living entity. Our material mind and body develop from the living entity, the soul, and being influenced by the three qualities of matter, we forget our real identity. The jnana process theoretically speculates about the reality of the soul, but bhakti yoga factually engages the spirit soul in activities. The perception of matter is transcended to still subtler states of the senses. The senses are transcended to the subtler mind, and then to breathing activities, and gradually to intelligence. Beyond the intelligence, the living soul is realized by the mechanical activities of the yoga system, or practice of meditation, restraining the senses, regulating the breathing system, and applying intelligence to rise to the transcendental position. This trance or practice of meditation, restraining the senses, regulating the breathing system, and applying intelligence to rise to the transcendental position. This trance stops all material activities of the body. The king saw the Muni in that position. He also saw the Muni as follows. So the next verse will be describing the external appearance of the Muni. Shamakarisha. Shamakarishi. Prati rudendriya prana mano buddhim uparatam stana triyat paramprapam brahma bhutam avikriyam. The Muni sense organs, breath, mind, and intelligence were all restrained from material activities, and he was situated in a trance apart from the three, wakefulness, dream, and unconsciousness, having achieved a transcendental position qualitatively equal with the Supreme Absolute. So here is a description of the Brahma-Bhuta stage. Samadhi, entering into samadhi. So this is the goal of any transcendental system. Actually, for bhakti yogis, this is not the ultimate goal. This is the platform from which the goal is achieved. This Brahma-Bhuta stage. This is from the position of the bhakti yogis. Brahma-Bhuta is a full wakefulness from which one can develop one's siddhadeya. But for the impersonalists, this Brahma-Bhuta is the goal. Of course, even for the yogis, they want to go beyond Brahma-Bhuta to understanding the Paramatma. So even for them, it's a stepping stone. But, you know, most people today who take up some religion or some spiritual process in the world today, I mean, my guess is that the vast majority of people who consider themselves religious do not have anything equivalent to this Brahma-Bhuta stage or samadhi as their goal. I remember years ago, my doctor in North Carolina became a Buddhist. He was American, he became a Buddhist. And he said to me, "Do you have any concept in your religious system of enlightenment?" So generally, if you go to any of the Christian denominations, I mean, even the ones who are a little different, like Jehovah's Witnesses or Seventh-day Adventists or the Mormons, or you go to any Jewish congregation, any of the varieties of them, or Islamic or Hindu even, you are Buddhist, you'll not find this emphasis on Brahma-Bhuta and enlightenment and samadhi. What you find is generally an emphasis on karmakanda. People want to go to heaven. They want a nice life in this world. They're taking up religion because they believe, well, if I take up religion, then I'll have a better relationship with my wife. My wife will be nice to me when I get home. My children will be well behaved. You know, I'll have enough money. I'll have prosperity. I'll have good health. I'll enjoy in this world. In this planet will be like heaven. And after death, I will go to some heavenly place for enjoyment. So this is generally the concept. I'll still stay in my same mood, my same ahankara, that I am a material being, that I am an enjoyer of the world, but I'll be pious. So that's generally the mentality. I mean, even when they talk about salvation, and generally when religionists talk about salvation in the modern age, they're really talking about being saved from suffering and attaining some sort of heavenly realm. You know, even you could say wanting the kinds of liberation mentioned even in the Bhagavatam is wanting to be in Vaikuntha, wanting to be in a super heavenly realm. That's basically what's motivating them. And this emphasis on attaining Brahma-Bhuta or Nirvana or enlightenment, basically self-realization, God-realization, it tends to be tends to be put to the realm of the mystics. It's not for the people in general. Just like I recently read St. Teresa's book, The Seven Interior Mansions of the Soul, where she seems to be describing a process of Shraddha to Prema, and she's describing Madhurya Rasa and how she's in Madhurya Rasa with the Lord, and she spends a lot of time describing the two highest positions, which certainly seem equivalent to bhava and prema. And interestingly enough, most Catholic priests and theologians, as part of their ministerial training, read this book. But we don't find that this sort of preaching as the goal is given to Catholics in general. You know, when you're going to church, if you're reading Catholic books, it's not that people are generally talking about achieving this sort of goal. It's not the main emphasis. The same with the Sufi mystics or the Jewish studiers of the Kabbalah. So these are often the teachings are not even publicly known. So in Judaism, to study the Kabbalah, you have to be at least 40 years old, you have to be a man, you have to be a rabbi, you have to have qualified yourself in so many ways before you can even study the book. I remember in Chicago, two students of the Kabbalah who came to the temple because they said in the Kabbalah they had read that God is a blue boy who takes care of cows. Having not read it myself, I don't know, but that's what they said.
My mom read it.
So this, of course, these mystic traditions, they were considered that to study them you needed a personal guru, you needed a personal guide, and so forth. Now, what's happening today is because most of the religious systems do not talk about attaining Brahma-Bhuta or enlightenment or nirvana or samadhi or whatever term one wants to use for it, there is becoming, because the human soul is yearning, Prabhupada says the need of the soul is to be free. The need of the soul is to be in the spirit and the light and to attain this freedom. A wonderful purport in the first canto where Prabhupada talks about the need of the soul. So in psychology, they teach that if something is a need, it can't really be denied. It's like we have a need for air, and you can hold your breath, but eventually your body will start breathing automatically. So if there's something that's a need, you really can't deny it for a long time. It will reassert itself in some form, which reminds me, of course, what Krishna says about our nature. Even though it's only our nature in this body and in this life, where he tells Arjuna that you have to follow your nature. He says, if you refuse to fight for me, you will be induced to fight anyway. But you'll fight in a materialistic way, and then you'll become entangled in material nature. It's not a choice. You can't say, well, I'm just not going to follow my nature. I'm going to repress my nature. Krishna says it will assert itself anyway. And Krishna's talking about a temporary external nature in this particular life. What to speak of the actual nature of the soul, which is to become, as Prabhupada describes it here, qualitatively equal with the Supreme Absolute. That's how Srila Prabhupada is defining Brahma-Bhuta in this particular verse. So because that's a need of the soul, we find that if the religious systems of the world are not really teaching about it, if it's just in their mystical traditions to which the general adherents have very little access and there's very little discussion about it, then people, at least some people, are going to look elsewhere. So just like over the weekend, we were on the other side of the island, we were in Kona, and we did some nice programs there at a devotee's home. And the devotees were invited to go to the installation of a shrine and a museum of some other yoga group. And I found it very interesting. There weren't that many people there, maybe 20, maybe 30. But very few of them were Indian. They were from non-Indian backgrounds. And they were considering themselves Hindu. I asked a few of them, you know, do you think of yourself as a Hindu? They said, oh, yes. And their aim was Brahman. Their aim was moksha. Their aim was enlightenment. So they had become disgusted with the teachings of the religious system that religion is simply for increased material enjoyment, and they wanted something higher. So we also, in the Hare Krishna movement, we have to be always mindful of what is our real goal. And we are very blessed, of course, as followers of Srila Prabhupada, that even the most beginning follower, I mean, it doesn't take more than a few weeks to a month of contact with the Hare Krishna movement before you figure out that the highest goal is prema. higher even than moksha. You can't really associate with the Hare Krishna movement in any depth or with Srila Prabhupada's books in any depth and continue some concept that the goal of spirituality and the goal of religion is simply a nice material arrangement. I mean, there are some people who hold to that, who feel that the number one purpose of Srila Prabhupada's preaching is, for example, to establish Varnashram, which is certainly one of Prabhupada's desire, but they may think that that's his primary desire, to establish a peaceful, prosperous society that acts as a base for bhakti. But our preaching, as Prabhupada's followers, is very direct. We have no hesitancy about saying what is our sadhya, what is our goal. And our goal is factually beyond Brahma-Bhuta. Brahma-Bhuta is you realize who you are, and bhakti is you act according to who you are. You don't just stay in this realization that I am spirit. What do I do as spirit? What are my activities as spirit? What's my particular individual nature as spirit? But certainly Brahma-Bhuta is the foundation for that. You can't talk about one's activities of spirit if one hasn't realized that one is spirit. So here Prabhupada's saying that this Brahma-Bhuta platform can be achieved in three ways. Let's look a little bit about what this Brahma-Bhuta platform or samadhi is. Well, here it's described, it's above the three, triyat. Above the three, triyat param. So the three, sthana triyat param, he's staying in a place or an achieve, we could say the whole line, sthana triyat param praptam. He's achieved a place that's above the three. So this is describing the three levels of consciousness, wakefulness, dream, and unconsciousness. So in material life, we tend to think that we are most conscious when we are awake, least conscious in deep sleep, and in the middle in dream. Actually, it's reversed. When we're in wakefulness, we're aware of the world of the senses, which Srila Prabhupada talks about here as the lowest state. And actually, he talks about the lowest state as matter. This is very much related to in Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says the senses are superior to dull matter, the mind is superior to the senses, the intelligence is superior to the mind, and above that is the soul. So the lowest state, one is just conscious of matter. One is not even aware of their own sense perception. We could say like a little tiny baby is something in that way. A baby is hardly aware of their own senses, and some of the lower animals are like that. All they're aware of is matter. All they're aware of is, I want food. Then above that is the realm of the senses, and above that to the mind. So what we call our waking state is the state of the senses and the mind. And most people that I've met are hardly even aware of the activities of their own mind. You know, if you're only on the platform of the senses, that would be practically animal life. Just, I smell something and I want to eat it. You know, I see something, I want to get it, without even being aware of any kind of logical functions. But it's very hard to be aware of the mind, the thinking, feeling, and willing of the mind. I mean, there's a lot of psychological techniques to get you more aware of the thinking and feeling processes of the mind. As a teacher, I had years of training in teaching and counseling how to become aware of the movements of one's own mind. And when you learn these things, you realize that most people are not aware of their own thought process or their own emotions. And just becoming aware of those takes you above the platform of the senses and gross matter. It's quite a freeing and peaceful experience, even just to come to the platform of understanding the mind. Now, the mind is functioning on the platform of dreams. So the dream state is the state of the mind, which is higher than that of the senses. We find many times that there are great devotees to whom Krishna appears in dreams. rather than in their walking life. When one is in a dream state, one is in a more subtle position. One is not as much in materialistic consciousness. Then the state of the intelligence, Jnanamoya, that is hardly accessed at all. And when we experience this state, which is deep sleep, we're generally not even aware of anything. It's as if we don't exist, because for most of us, we cannot really access the intelligence. For one who can access the intelligence, they have alertness in this deep sleep state where the mind is quiet. In fact, what many people call samadhi is simply quieting the mind, which the mind being a product of the mode of goodness, the mind is very happy when it's quiet. Quieting the senses and coming to the platform of intelligence. So as I said, this is very unusual. You don't find very many people who are capable of doing that through either of the two processes other than bhakti mentioned here, through jnana or through yoga. I mean, you do have, say, hypnotists who are able to bring someone else to the platform of intelligence, but the hypnotist becomes the intelligence of the person. They quiet the person's mind and senses, and the hypnotist acts as the intelligence. And when the person comes out of the trance, they have no awareness of what they did, as if they were in deep sleep. But for a person to come to that level of trance and function in their own intelligence is quite rare in the present age. Some people can do that, but it's extremely unusual. So we think, you know, the persons in Kali Yuga consider the platform of intelligence to be like non-existence. Then above that is the platform of the soul, the Brahma-Bhuta platform. And on that platform, one's awareness of matter, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence is quieted. One becomes aware of one's real self. So that is samadhi. Samadhi is preceded by pratyahara. Pratyahara is what's very much described here, where the sense organs, the breath, the mind, and intelligence were all restrained from material activities. They're in a quiescent state. They're basically turned off. Now, even if you can turn the mind off to some extent, you can do amazing things. And Prabhupada talks about this in Teachings of Lord Kapila, how Stalin had a surgical operation without anesthesia because he could situate the mind in a particular way. So even if you can partially enter into this trance and just quiet the mind, then you're able to tolerate a surgical operation and not feel pain. I actually met a medical doctor who was allergic to anesthesia and had some abdominal major surgery without anesthesia, just by putting herself into a state of trance, even though it wasn't such a deep trance as coming fully to the platform of intelligence, what to speak of coming to Brahma-Bhuta. So the general symptoms of samadhi is that a person appears practically like they're dead. Just like when Mahaprabhu fainted in the temple of Jagannath Puri, people weren't sure if he was even alive. I mean, we're speaking from a material point of view, obviously. He's the Supreme Lord. He has a spiritual body. But from an external point of view, it looked like he was dead. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya put this little cotton by the Lord's nose and saw there was some small breath. Or Dhruva Maharaj, who stopped breathing. He was only breathing, once a month or something like that. So once every 3 months. Anyway, very rarely. He wasn't breathing very often. So there are persons who, from the yoga process, even today, can do this sort of thing. There was that gentleman, Wolf Messing, who could enter a catatonic state over a weekend. And he had the way he maintained himself, this is really funny, but the way he maintained himself was he worked in a wax museum as if he were a wax sculpture, because he could go into a catatonic state for a weekend. And he met yogis in India who could go into such a state for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. So this is generally the symptom of samadhi, that one loses one's awareness of the external world. Of course, all of us experience this, again, in deep sleep. In dreaming, we lose most of our perception of the external world. In deep sleep, we lose all of our perception of the external world. The only sense that can become active, that can get us out of that, generally is hearing, sometimes touch. And we even experience this to some extent if we're in tremendous anxiety about something, or if we're tremendously joyful. If we have some sort of extreme emotion, we will sometimes lose all awareness of our external surroundings. We won't hear what people say, we won't see them, we just won't be aware of anything. We also enter into this state in extreme physical pain. So when there's great physical pain, you lose your awareness or your concern for anything. Nothing else matters. If the pain is very, very extreme, you don't care that your bills aren't paid or that your husband hasn't taken out the trash for 3 months or your children haven't brushed their teeth or whatever. It all becomes inconsequential. And people in a lot of pain, say nearing the time of death, will also become like that. Their universe shrinks, so to speak, and they lose all awareness or concern. Like Bhaktivedanta Swami said, death takes away everything that's false. Basically, you become unconcerned and even to a lot extent unaware of what's going on around you. So these are some things that imitate to some extent this state of samadhi, although generally on a material level, you know, if it's extreme physical pain or extreme material emotions, we're certainly not experiencing something that we would call bliss. But we have some concept that it's possible to enter into this state. I mean, everyone, even the most gross materialist, has some experience that such a state is possible, which Krishna describes in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that when one enters into such a trance, especially he's talking about the highest level of trance, where one sees the self, as described here, the Brahma-Bhuta stage, not just a trance where one's on the level of mind or one's on the level of intelligence, but a spiritual trance, that one is experiencing boundless transcendental happiness and feels there is no greater gain. Also interesting that Krishna says that one relishes and rejoices in the self. So of course this stage of Brahma-Bhuta is the stage of great humility, but in that stage of great humility one is relishing and rejoicing in the self. Humility is not self-hatred, although there is some shame. I was just reading this morning, Prabhupada says in Nectar Devotion, that the devotee feels some shame for their sinful activities. But that shame for sinful activities is coupled with the great relishing and rejoicing in the self. In fact, the shame in sinful activities is because one relishes and rejoices in the self and sees how glorious the self is, and therefore feels ashamed that such a glorious self could engage in such sinful activities. So how does one achieve this Brahma-Bhuta platform? So Prabhupada talks about three ways of achieving it. One is the process of jnana, or theoretical knowledge. Now this, to me anyway, is really astonishing. Theoretical knowledge, that one can, just by studying philosophy with the mind, just by speculating with the mind according to the shastras, one can achieve Brahma-Bhuta. Now of course it takes a long time. Bahunam janmanamante jnanamamam prapadyate. So to achieve Brahma-Bhuta through jnana takes many, 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 many lifetimes. So how does it work? When you study the scriptures and you realize that the desire to enjoy matter is illusion, and matter separate from Krishna is an illusion, and my identity as this body is an illusion, one becomes detached. And ultimately, everything is based on desire. I was just reading this also this morning, that the only price for attaining prema is desire. This world is working everything. This world, the spiritual world, everything is working according to desire. The New Agers who say that there's a law of attraction and a law of desire, they're right. They don't understand there's also a law of karma, perhaps. Some of them do. That it's not only desire, but it's also activities. It's, in other words, it's not just, oh, I would like that. It's intense desire, overwhelming desire. When the desire for spiritual life is very, very strong, and there is no other desire, not that it's one of a million desires and it manifests itself a little bit here and there. So that desire can come just through philosophical study. Just like we get desires for so many things, just by hearing about them intellectually. You know, by contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment. From such detachment, lust develops. Kama, great desire. So if you just think about, you know, you think about, oh, my husband will come home and he'll smile at me and he'll tell me I'm beautiful. If you think about that long enough, you become attached to it. You know, when I come home, my wife will have dinner ready and the house will be clean and she'll be smiling and everybody will say, welcome home. And then you become attached to it. And then when you don't get it, you become angry. You go into material consciousness. I mean, if you contemplate even something very small, you know, you contemplate a certain piece of jewelry or a certain car or a certain new telephone. And just like there's this company Apple, and I've heard, I don't have any of their products, but I've heard that people will stand in line for days to buy their new product. You know, they just hear about it. They see some demonstration, they hear about it, they meditate on it, and then they get this strong desire. I have to have this product. And they'll go practically without eating or sleeping just to get this product. So what to speak of if one contemplates the truth? If one meditates on, contemplates, talks about, studies, and if one's studying the scripture, eventually one's desire for the truth, one's desire for Brahman will become so strong that one will achieve it. Just simply by doing that. That's the process of Gyan. Then the process of yoga. Yoga is also really interesting. Manipulation, Prabhupada says here, of the physiological and psychological functions of the body. So I know some persons who are expert in this kind of yoga, some of whom are devotees. And they emphasize to me over and over again that it's a very mechanical process. In fact, what's really interesting is that there is a number of people who've achieved, at least temporarily, a Brahma-Bhuta state by some physiological and psychological manipulation. Now, sometimes a person will just, they'll have some sort of accident where the body and the mind become changed mechanically and they have an experience of Brahma-Bhuta. It's something mechanical. That there's a way of dealing with the muscles and the breath, etc. in the body. Just like the idea of asanas. That one puts the body in a particular position. One puts the body in a particular position, one breathes in a particular way. And if you're really good at that, that mechanical process will allow you to achieve Brahma-Bhuta. That's pretty amazing. Now, of course, there's desire involved in that also because the mechanical process of yoga is very difficult. It's not the kind of thing that you can say, oh, I'd like to do that. And, you know, you sit down for 15 minutes and you do it. One of my friends who's a very expert in mystic yoga, who's also a very nice devotee, said to me, listen, this is something you've got to practice 6 or 8 hours a day for years. It's not something you can sit down and do 15 minutes a day or an hour a day. It's just like anything else. You know, if you want to become an expert musician or you want to become, you know, the Olympic athletes, they're also practicing 8 hours a day. So there's obviously desire there. There has to be desire that motivates you to do it, etc. And according to the yoga ladder, you can't even engage in the process of mystic yoga unless you become qualified either by Gyan Yoga or by Karma Yoga. So one's not going to, for both Gyan Yoga and Dhyan Yoga or meditative yoga, for Gyan Yoga, you can't even engage in this sort of speculation and have it work unless you're first of all already a pious person. You have to have first of all done your Varnashram perfectly. And from that position, you can take up Gyan Yoga. And in order to take up Dhyan Yoga, you have to become expert in either Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga. So you can't be a sinful person, which is unfortunately the majority of the persons on earth right now in Kali Yuga, at least according to my experience. You can't be a sinful person and jump to Dhyan Yoga or even to Gyan Yoga. You just can't do it. So if you're going to sit around, it won't be effective. You're going to sit around and study the scriptures and speculate, and at the same time you're eating meat and you're drinking alcohol and you're not, you know, you're not being a good Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, you're not being a good Grihastha, or you're not being a good renunciate, you know, it's just not going to work. You've got to follow all of those principles first before you can actually engage in those systems. So the people sitting around speculating from the Shastras, and there are quite a lot of them, you know, there's a whole plethora of self-help books on how to attain enlightenment through speculation, and, you know, they may bring somebody to Sattvaguna, but they sure aren't going to bring you to Brahmabhuta. And the same with these people in their yoga studios where they're doing their asanas and their pratyahara so they can have a sexually appealing body. You know, and they're having illicit relationships between the yoga students and so forth. And you know, they're not going to attain Brahmabhuta. They can't even start the yoga process. Again, I mean, they may get healthier and they may come somewhat to a higher mode, but they're not going to attain transcendence. The processes don't work like that. However, it is interesting that this machine of the human body is designed to have the mechanics to allow Brahmabhuta. That the way that this machine works, the way that the subtle and gross body of the human form works, is if you know how to push the right buttons, you can attain Brahmabhuta. I mean, that's pretty interesting, that Krishna has given the soul and the human and the various 400,000 human species a machine that, at least for the earthly human body, is pretty lousy at sense gratification. And Prabhupada often talks about how we can't see as well as the eagles, you know, we can't mate as well as the pigeons, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's actually designed, even from a mechanical machine point of view, to facilitate self-realization. Now, Prabhupada says here, the most approved process of bhakti yoga. So how does bhakti yoga develop Brahmabhuta? Again, by desire. Now, what's nice about bhakti yoga is that it's kevala nandakanda, because from the beginning of bhakti yoga, even before attaining Brahmabhuta, one is engaged in activities of Brahman. One is engaged in the activities, as Prabhupada says here, the engagement of senses in the devotional service of the Lord. One is engaged in the activities of a liberated soul. Instead of first becoming liberated, just trying to stop everything and first becoming liberated and then trying to go to spiritual activities. Klesho dika dharashte sham avyakta ashakta sham avyakta hikatir dukam dehavad biravapite. One is immediately engaged in liberated activities from the beginning. Just like sometimes, you know, in driver's ed, first you have all the theoretical classes about driving and then you get in the car. But suppose you had the theoretical classes while you were getting in a car or while you were doing simulated driving. You know, you could have a driving simulator. That's how they train pilots, you know. They have these flying simulators now where you get in this machine. You're not really flying a plane, but you have an experience as if you're flying a plane. So bhakti yoga is something like that, that even in the beginning stages, it's as if you're flying the plane. Or if you want to do a drama, you know, from the very beginning, you're getting up and rehearsing. Even before you've memorized the script, even before you've really understood your character. You know, you spend a little time, perhaps before the first rehearsal, looking over the script, but very soon, you're rehearsing. You're acting as if you're in the real drama way before you're in the real drama. So that's the most fun and natural way to enter into Brahmabhuta. You act as if you're on the Brahmabhuta platform even before you are. Now, what are we going to do? What are we bhakti yogis going to do on the Brahmabhuta platform? You know, we're not just going to sit in a trance. We're going to give Radha Krishna flower garlands and food to eat and fan them and so many things. And we're already doing that. That's what we're doing every day. We're giving Krishna and Radha Krishna flowers and food and we're fanning them and etc. You know, we're going to talk to them. Well, that's what we're doing. We're sitting and chanting Hare Krishna. We're talking to them. We're saying so many prayers. Now, we might also mention that when we're talking about entering into Brahmabhuta and Samadhi and having being restrained from material activities. Sense, organ, breath, mind, and intelligence were all restrained from material activities. For the jnanis and the yogis, because they don't have activities of bhakti, when they're in samadhi, their material body and mind are inactive. They're dull. It's as if, again, they're in deep sleep. They're actually beyond deep sleep. So therefore, as the story continues, we don't want to get there too far, but in Maharaj Parikit, he saw the Muni like he was, practically speaking, dead. He wasn't responsive. He wasn't aware. But in bhakti, I mean, Prabhupada talks about, let's go to that purport. In Bhagavad Gita 12.2, Prabhupada talks about samadhi. And he says, for one in such Krishna consciousness, there are no material activities because everything is done for Krishna. A pure devotee is constantly engaged. Sometimes he chants, sometimes he hears or reads books about Krishna, or sometimes he cooks prasadam, or goes to the marketplace to purchase something for Krishna, or sometimes he washes a temple of the dishes. Whatever he does not let a single moment pass without devoting his activities to Krishna. Then Prabhupada says, such actions are in full samadhi. So this seems to be contradictory. We understand that samadhi is when your senses, your mind, and your intelligence are all stopped. There's no activities. But here Prabhupada talks about going to the marketplace. You got to drive there, or you got to walk there, or take your bicycle or something. You got to make sure you don't get hit by another vehicle. Oh, you've got to be aware of your surroundings. Or cooking prasadam, he mentions here. Reading books, washing the temple. You know, those are activities of the body, and you got to be breathing. You can't stop breathing. Well, I'm just not going to breathe anymore. You know, you can't be unaware of what other people are doing. So why is that samadhi? Because one is not engaged in material activities. And that's a matter of consciousness. Just like we sing in the prayers to the spiritual master, Nikunja yuno rati keli siddhaya yayali bir yukti ira pekshaniya tachrati daksha rati valabhasya vande guru shri charanarvindam. That also means, it certainly means that one is experiencing within, that one is engaged in transcendent activities in the spiritual world, but it also means that one's activities in this world are seen like that, and one can do that, anyone can do that. In the system of yoga or the system of jnana, such consciousness comes after many, many, many years of expert practice. But in bhakti, one can do this very easily and naturally. One can think, well, one's doing one's activities. I'm serving Radha and Krishna. I'm serving Mahaprabhu. I'm serving my spiritual master. Because one is. I mean, of course, if one isn't, that's something else. But if one is, if one's activities are actually dedicated to Krishna, if one's not actually engaged in materialistic activities with the senses, then it's just a question of bringing the consciousness in alignment with the activities of the senses. And then one will attain the Brahma-Bhuta platform. When Arjuna asks for the symptoms of Brahma-Bhuta, which Krishna describes mostly as being equipoise, being unattached by, unaffected by happiness and distress, fame and infamy, good and bad, you know, non-Brahma-Bhuta, somebody insults you, you're offended. Something doesn't go your way, you're upset, etc. So Brahma-Bhuta is equanimity, detachment. And how to attain that? Mam chayo vyavicharani, bhakti yogena sevate, sagunan samatityaita, brahma-bhuyaya kalpate. So Krishna says, one who's engaged in devotional service in all circumstances at once transcends the modes of material nature and comes to the level of Brahman, comes to this level of Brahma-Bhuta. So if we always have our consciousness, I'm doing this for Krishna, I'm doing this for Krishna. I mean, if we have deities in our house or an altar in our house, you have a picture of Radha Krishna there, then everything, you clean your house, you're cleaning the groves for Radha and Krishna. And if your house is a mess, you're not. You know, it's very simple. You're cooking for Radha Krishna. You've got Gaur Nitai. You're cooking for Gaur Nitai. You're cleaning the place of Gaur Nitai. And what about our heart? In our heart is Krishna. So in our heart, when we're trying to become a better person, we're trying to treat the other people in our life nicely to make our heart clean. Now what are we doing? We're cleaning our heart. We're cleaning the grove of the Lord. We're decorating the grove of the Lord. All our attempts to be a better person, to be a person that Krishna wants to associate with, to have our everything in our life. You're going out and earning money. What are you earning money for? You're earning money to take care of the home in which you live and who's the master of your home. Now, if you're thinking it's my home, I'm earning money for my home so I can buy the shoes that I want and I can go on the vacation that I want and I can buy the furniture that I want, then you're in material consciousness. And if you're thinking, Nikuncha, you know, Rati Keli Sidai. Just like the gopis, they're going out collecting flowers to decorate Radha Krishna's groves. You know, the cowherd boys, they're collecting their plates to eat on, to have a picnic lunch with Krishna. Mother Yasoda, she's making sure the home is nice. So whatever we're doing, if we think this is Krishna's home, I'm doing it for Krishna, we can be in samadhi. We can be on the platform of Brahmabhuta. We can be factually above Brahmabhuta. That depends on us. And we might say, oh, well, it's very difficult because not all the people in my life support that. Well, you know, even in Goloka Vrindavan, there's an apparent situation like that, where many of the gopis have husbands and in-laws, etc., who at least externally appear not to support their service to Radha and Krishna. And but what to speak of in Gokula, in Vrindavan, in the material world, even demons come. And there's devotees at all levels of realizations who are in training for the spiritual world. It's not that everybody in Gokula Vrindavan is on a pure devotional platform. Some of them are actually even demons. So even in this life, we're in training, and we can see like that. As soon as we see like that, then we also experience samadhi, even if we're driving to the marketplace, or even if we're driving to work to get money for the marketplace. And if we neglect the material side of our life, thinking it's material, that's not bhakti. Maybe that's gyan or jnana, but it sure isn't bhakti. Well, maybe in gyan or jnana, maybe you leave everything. Of course, most of the gyan yogis are also grihasthas, Manu Swami told me. But maybe some of them, they leave everything, you know, they neglect everything in the name of, oh, I'm just going to focus on the spiritual, so I don't have to take care of my parents or my wife or whatever, my kitchen, you know, my car, because it's all material. I'll just study the scriptures and I'll just meditate and let everything go to hell. So that may be the mood of the jnana yogi. You know, the jnana yogi, they left everything. And when the jnana yogi is in samadhi, all of the activities of the body and mind and intelligence just stop. Whereas with a bhakti yogi, the material activities stop. Because the gyan yogi and the dhyan yogi don't have a concept of spiritual activities. When they attain Brahmabhuta, everything stops. For the bhakti yogi, we have a concept of spiritual activities. Therefore, nothing stops. Just the quality of it changes and the experience of the person doing it changes. And this is true even if you're taking care of the trash, the rubbish. The other day I was with some devotee, we were taking care of the rubbish, and this devotee was complaining, you know, I don't want to take care of the rubbish. I said, just chant Nikunjayuno Rati Keli Siddhayi. So just like Jayananda, he was taking care of the rubbish. He was the garbage man. Jayananda is the only member of the Hare Krishna movement that Srila Prabhupada said we should celebrate his disappearance day, like we do all the other great saints. And there were some other devotees who left their body in Prabhupada's manifest presence. But Prabhupada wanted us to put Jayananda on our calendar, and he was the garbage man. I mean, he did other things also, but what other things did he do? I mean, he was held present, I think, for about a year. But he went around buying the boga. He went shopping for the boga. He physically built the Rathiatra carts. You know, those are all what we would consider materially very low-level jobs. But remember one devotee who joined in the temple where Jayananda was. Actually, first he was just visiting, and the temple president said, well, why don't you start off by helping Jayananda there with the trash? And the man decided to stay and become a devotee. He said, wow, if the trash people are so blissful, just imagine what everybody else is. So it doesn't matter. Just like Prabhupada says, whatever is meant to be, I am doing. If one is following the rules in Krishna consciousness, whatever is meant to be, I am doing. Never mind what it is. Let me do it to my best ability with full attention to every detail, that Krishna's pleasure alone is my motive. And then when doing that, one is in samadhi. Sometimes we're afraid, well, if I attain realization, if I attain enlightenment, I'll be neglectful in my material duties. But that's not what we see. We see Srila Prabhupada, we see the six Goswamis, Bhakti Siddhanta, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Baladev Vijayabhushan. They were all expert in their material activities, more expert than the materialists, because their activities weren't material. They were in a different state of consciousness. So how much easier and more natural it is to attain this Brahma-Bhuta through bhakti. So, of course, with these two people here, we have Shamaka Rishi, who's attained Brahma-Bhuta through dhyan. And we have Maharaj Parikshit, who's also on the Brahma-Bhuta platform through bhakti. So this is what we should be striving for, and we should be striving for it now. Not to think, oh, this is something for the future. Right now, let me be in illusion and miserable and suffer, and because what can I do? And later, after I become a great devotee, then I'll enter into samadhi. No, why not enter into samadhi now? Entering into samadhi now does not mean sitting at Radhakund and, you know, just chanting Radhe Radhe all day long. That was not what Srila Prabhupada wanted us to do. It means going to the marketplace for Krishna. It means doing everything thinking for Krishna. So, questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions, chastisements, etc.
It's interesting, at the end you mentioned Jayananda. And it is true. Srila Prabhupada canonized Jayananda and
you know, and told us we should have them on our calendar. And throughout your presentation, I was like, and I liked at the end you were saying that being in samadhi, somebody's fixed in the idea of Krishna's pleasure is my motive in doing this, Srila Prabhupada's pleasure is my motive in doing this. So it's interesting. The prominent devotees that have become, you know, in charge of Prabhupada's movement, I would hope that that's their consciousness. Krishna's pleasure is my motive. Sure, Prabhupada's pleasure is my motive in everything I do. But it seems like when you take positions, you know, there's going to be some mixed desires there. Whereas Jayananda, he was just the embodiment of Trinada Pisini Chayana. Although he did have a position as a temple president earlier on, that was the position that he took. He took the position of the garbage man. And he got the recognition of Srila Prabhupada. That was interesting how it all ended.
Well, further on in this story of Maharaj Parikshit, Prabhupada makes an interesting comment that although Maharaj Parikshit was a great devotee, a pure devotee of the Lord, that he had become attached to some extent materially by being the emperor. And therefore Krishna created this pastime, of course for many reasons, but one reason was to remove him from that position to which he had become attached. So we see that there is the vanaprastha and the sannyas ashram. that mostly it's in the grihastha ashram that one should be engaged in these sorts of managerial or administrative positions if one is a kshatriya. And that the great Rajarshis, they retired. They went away from that position at the end of life because it's, of course, it's possible. We're not saying that if a person leaves their body in that, while they're in that place. You know, we've seen devotees who had very incredible deaths, although they were young and in the grihastha ashram and engaged in things in the world. But generally, the principle is that at the end of life, that one detach oneself from these things, because even if one is a completely pure devotee, there's some risk of thinking, you know, I'm the controller, I'm the enjoyer, and so forth, in that sort of a situation. And we see that Srila Prabhupada, at first, he wanted all of the managers to be grihasthas, and later he made the leaders from the sannyasis. Basically, Prabhupada didn't have a very large pool of people to choose from, and the people that he felt were the most qualified as leaders, he had to use in this dual position of a sannyasi and as a manager. But that wasn't what Srila Prabhupada felt to be the ideal thing. So it's certainly, we've seen practically, it's incompatible and somewhat dangerous for the individual and for the society, for people who are in the renounced ashram to be managing towns and villages. Someone in the renounced ashram could manage a mat or, you know, a small school or something like that. But to be managing a village, that is actually for the Brahmin Kshatriyas. And this fact is, I see, one reason why Srila Prabhupada started more and more emphasizing in his later years with us about Varnashram, that putting people in the right position, that if you put somebody who's in the renounced order in a position where they're having to deal a lot with women and money and power, then you're going to make things very difficult for them. So, my own experience with meeting many, many persons who take on leadership roles in Mahaprabhu's mission is that most of the people I've met are really trying their best to work just for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. Of course, I don't know what's in their heart, but that's at least my experience. And I also see, though, that the position itself is very dangerous. Any position where one has a lot of power and is dealing with a lot of money and a lot of adoration from the opposite sex and so forth, without having any sort of means in one's own position to deal with those things righteously in Krishna's service, is really in a difficult position. And we see that even very great souls, when they're in that kind of position, they feel that they've become somewhat compromised. Amaraj Priyavrata is another example, that after doing the service for Krishna, he did the service of ruling the world for Guru and Krishna, certainly, undoubtedly, but he still felt that he had become somewhat compromised, and therefore he renounced it at the end. He said, this is not... Or Arjuna... You know, Arjuna, who all of his facilities for rulership were taken away because that wasn't required for going back to home, back to Godhead. So we see Srila Prabhupada himself, he kept trying to give the managerial type things to others so that he could just focus on being a translator and a writer and a speaker and a counselor, rather than being in a position of managerial power. It's quite interesting, in fact, with Srila Prabhupada, that Srila Prabhupada did everything he could to avoid establishing ISKCON as a personality cult centered around himself. He very, very quickly established a GBC, turned over management and leadership to others. He diffused management and leadership among his disciples as much as he could, having, you know, disciples who were mostly not trained from birth in Vedic principles and so forth. But Srila Prabhupada really put Krishna in the center, and he really diffused power very, very early on. I mean, to some extent, his society suffered because of that. In my opinion, a lot of the historical problems we had in ISKCON were because there was a lot of power in the hands of immature people. But the upside of having a lot of power in the hands of those people is that we did not establish some kind of a personality cult. And Srila Prabhupada did this, I'm sure, for many, many reasons, but I would imagine that one of them was to keep himself in a position of humility and keep himself in a position of safety. Not that he needed that, but that was his mood. Just like we saw at this program we went to last weekend, where we were invited, where they were inaugurating this museum for this one guru, this one lady guru, who's no longer on the planet. And her disciples worship her as some sort of an avatar. So this kind of thing, you know, when the leader puts himself in the center and when the leader gives himself a lot of authority, of course these sort of things can happen anyway, that people start saying that the leader is actually God. But it's so much more likely for that to happen, for people to inflate and distort the position of the leader. So it's interesting that when we talk about following Srila Prabhupada's example in terms of leadership, that there was a tendency in the early days after Srila Prabhupada left us for the leaders to think, oh, that means imitating the size of Srila Prabhupada's Vyasa son. You know, and that means imitating the amount of respect and regard for Prabhupada's words as being as good as Shastra, that my word should now be good as Shastra. But they didn't imitate was Srila Prabhupada's focus on decentralization and unbureaucracy. And Prabhupada said, don't have centralization and bureaucracy. And Srila Prabhupada himself, very quickly, I mean, in the early days, there was what we call a simple structure, where Prabhupada was running everything because everything was so small and new, but very, very quickly. I mean, we're talking about within like 3 years, Srila Prabhupada established a non-centralized, a decentralized system of authority and an organic rather than bureaucratic way of managing. Simply to set that example of how a leader, especially a leader in the renounced order, helps prevent themselves from being corrupted by power and by authority. So sorry for that whole sociological analysis there.
It's interesting. Are persons in management aware of this idea that they've done something that Prabhupada didn't want?
Some. Some of them.
Because I think, you know, I'm not
blaming anybody in particular, but it seems like it's really had devastating effects in the movement.
I agree. And one of the things that I personally try to do is make a lot of propaganda, like I'm doing now. And, you know, I also do it in other ways. In front of the room, behind the room, in speaking, in writing, and so forth and so on, to try to remind people that Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, because Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's institution had the same problem, or similar problem, to remind people that Srila Prabhupada set up a decentralized organic system, not a centralized bureaucratic system, and that centralized bureaucratic systems have a very deleterious effect on a spiritual society and on the people who take leadership roles in that society, on their own spiritual life and on their own relationships with others, and that's not the direction we should go in. My experience is most devotees that I talk to, that's very anecdotal, but most devotees that I talk to think that organization and centralization and bureaucracy are synonymous. They can't imagine a decentralized, non-bureaucratic organization. They don't even know what that would look like. So they think, well, if there's an organization, it's got to be bureaucratic and it's got to be centralized. They may not use those words, but that's the conception that I run into. And they think that if you're saying you can have a decentralized, unbureaucratic organization, they're saying that they equate that with anarchy. The immediate response I'll get is, "Oh, you're suggesting anarchy." You're suggesting that you want to destroy the organization. That's what I get. And I get that not only from leaders, but from rank and file. I get it in general. That people can't, right. They can't make a mental picture of a decentralized, unbureaucratic organization. It seems to them to be an oxymoron. Now, what's particularly interesting is that right now in management circles, if you read books on management, which I do a lot, my master's and PhD are both in management of educational nonprofit type, organizations, not business organizations. And I still continue to read quite a lot on management, not as much as I did in school, but anyway. What's happening now in management in the world is a push away from the centralized and the bureaucratic. It's very interesting that the materialistic managers, even people working in for-profit business, are seeing that the centralized bureaucratic model is a soul-killing model. Actually, I would say the centralized bureaucratic model is a very low grade Shudra model. It's a model that's necessary for the lowest grades of Shudras, even the higher grades of Shudras. The guy who has his flip flop fixing business on the side of the road in Vrindavan is working in a very decentralized, unbureaucratic way. He just has his little slab of stone that he sits on, and he works whenever he feels like working, and nobody tells him what to do or how to do it, and there's no rules. He can, work it as he goes along. So it's really very, very low-grade sutras who function well in a highly centralized, highly bureaucratic environment. And so anyway, I do find it of interest that you can read now dozens of books and seminars, et cetera, et cetera, and there's many examples of companies who are setting up systems which are decentralized and unbureaucratic. Now, of course, this hasn't come into the mainstream of the majority of organizations, but it's there. And the people propounding these things are making quite a lot of noise about it and giving a lot of step-by-step guidance. What's perhaps even more fascinating is some of the people who are propounding this the most, like Peter Senge, are Buddhists. They're Western Buddhists. And they are going to Eastern traditions to show how do you have an organizational culture that fosters the Brahma-Bhuta state of meditation. And they go for an decentralized, unbureaucratic model. It's really fascinating. And what I would love to see, what I had intended to work on when I was here in Hawaii, but Krishna's doing something else with me, but what I would like to see is that we have some devotees who start going to our own traditions and our own shastras and come up with models of leadership and management that are, shall I say, samadhi models. What does samadhi management look like? What is a samadhi? What does a Brahma-Bhuta management system look like? How is it done on a practical level? I mean, if the Buddhists can talk about it, and these are big guys who are producing this Buddhist stuff. I mean, they're teaching management at MIT. They are some of the leaders in the world, leader management, leadership and management gurus of the world. They're highly respected. You go to one of their seminars, you're going to be paying $5,000. And they're teaching, of course, they're teaching it in an impersonal way, but they're teaching management systems based on each person in the system and the system as a whole being in samadhi. So that's what we should be doing. We want to have and that's the whole idea of varnashram also, that you want to have external structures which support an internal state of consciousness. You want to try to have a match between how things are established on the external level and the state of consciousness you want to achieve. Now, of course, the state of consciousness is not dependent on any material arrangement. You can be in samadhi in a Soviet labor camp. But we don't want to set up a spiritual organization like a Soviet labor camp and say, well, you can be in samadhi in any circumstance, therefore just get on with it. Okay, it's getting very late. I think I want to end here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.